Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the latest brazen barrage of lies about the Affordable Care Act levelled by House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, whose false claims about a CBO report confirming Republican assertions that Obamacare will cost millions of Americans their jobs has been thoroughly debunked by factcheck.org. Elise Gould, the Director of Health Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute, joins us to discuss her article, No, the CBO Did Not Find That the ACA Kills Jobs, and whether the relentless misinformation about the Affordable Care Act will eventually be trumped by facts on the ground. Then we'll get an analysis of what is wrong with the trillion-dollar farm bill the President is about to sign as a shining example of bipartisan cooperation. Craig Cox, the Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group, joins us to examine what he calls a bait and switch in removing one boondoggle and replacing it with another that is even more likely to explode the budget savings, which are half of what the President asked for and come at the expense of almost a million poor families who will get their food stamps cut while agribusiness will be able to write their own ticket on how much subsidies they get. Then finally, we will look into the unprecedented rebuke to the Catholic Church from the United Nations, whose Committee on the Rights of the Child have called upon the Vatican to immediately remove child abusers. The former religion editor at the New York Times, Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter, joins us to discuss the UN Committee's call for the popular new Pope Francis to open up the Vatican's files on members of the clergy who have concealed their crimes so that the abusers could be held accountable by the authorities. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elise Gould, who's the Director of Health Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute, where her research areas include employer-sponsored health insurance, inequality and health, poverty, economic mobility, and the employer tax exclusion. She is a co-author of The State of Working America, 12th edition, and she just wrote the piece, No, the CBO Did Not Find That the ACA Kills Jobs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elise Gould.
Thank you for having me.
And your article, No, the CBO Did Not Find That the ACA Kills Jobs, appears to be in response to Eric Cantor and Michelle Bachmann, not exactly unimpeachable sources to begin with. But Eric Cantor took to the tweet when the CBO report came out and said, the CBO's latest report confirms what Republicans have been saying for years now. Under Obamacare, millions of hardworking Americans will lose their jobs, and those who keep them will see their hours and wages reduced. Is that what prompted you to write your reply?
Well, it wasn't a direct reply, but I can see how you would see it that way. I just thought it was important to get the truth out there about what the CBO report actually found, and it's absolutely not the same as what you just reported there. If I were to quote directly from the CBO report, and I think this makes it very clear, what they say is that the estimated reduction, and they're talking about the reduction in jobs, the reduction in employment, stems almost entirely from a net decline in the amount of labor that workers choose to supply rather than from a net drop in businesses' demand for labor. So it's not about businesses not wanting to hire workers or anything like that. It's about people voluntarily deciding to leave the labor force or to work part-time rather than full-time.
And you attribute this to what you refer to as the job lock.
That's right. That's right. So there's this phenomenon that economists, labor economists, have long studied called job lock. And job lock is a phenomenon whereby people stay in or secure a job just to get particular benefits that that job can offer. And in this case, we're talking about employer-sponsored health insurance benefits. So there's a lot of research that shows that somebody who's close to retirement, let's say 62, otherwise would like to retire now, maybe they have the economic security to retire, but they can't get health insurance because they haven't reached the Medicare eligibility age yet of 65. And so at 62, they think, okay, well, I have to just stick with this full-time job until I'm 65 so I can keep the insurance I need. And you say the same thing with workers who may want to work part-time. Let's say they want to work part-time and stay home with their young kids, but they can't get health insurance for their family unless they work full-time. And so they have to work full-time as opposed to part-time. Another example would be somebody who, let's say, is working full-time at a job, and it's not the best thing for them. They want to leave that job and maybe start their own business. But because of the way the insurance markets have worked for so long in this country, they can't go and start their own business because they'll lose their health insurance that they have, and maybe they have a kid who's sick, or maybe they have a spouse who's sick and needs to have that health insurance all the time. And so that's what we call job lock. And job lock is mainly because employer-sponsored insurance has been pretty much the only option for people that are not eligible for Medicaid or Medicare in this country.
So in a curious way, I wonder why we're even having this discussion. You would think in a civilized society that the notion that people would have less stress, would have more choice, and would have the option to work less, comforted by the knowledge that they have health care without being stuck in a job that they don't necessarily want or like, isn't that a win-win in the real world?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a win-win. I think that the results of the CBO report are getting misconstrued, and people are talking about it as if there's job loss, as if there's some sort of employment loss, net employment loss, and that's not what they're suggesting at all. They're suggesting that people now have more choice. Right? And more choice is great because we've reformed the individual insurance market. So they didn't have the choice before because the individual insurance market discriminated against with people with, you know, pre-existing conditions. You know, you couldn't insure your family if your kid was sick. All sorts of different things we know. Now with these new state-based insurance exchanges, we've reformed the individual insurance marketplace such that it is a place to find high-quality, affordable insurance. There is another option for people, and now you can have a more efficient labor market. It is absolutely a win-win.
Again, I'm speaking with Elise Gould, who's the Director of Health Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute, where her research areas include employer-sponsored health insurance, inequality in health, poverty, economic mobility, and the employer tax exclusion. She is a co-author of The State of Working America, 12th edition, and she just wrote the piece, No, the CBO Did Not Find That the ACA Kills Jobs. And that piece is available at your website, Elise?
That's correct, www.epi.org. We have a blog there, Working Economics blog, and you can find it there.
So, but the point-by-point refuting of what Eric Cantor's false claims are against the CBA report, which have been debunked, they're being debunked along with the Michelle Bachmann's extraordinary claims that the ACA would kill 800,000 jobs. This factcheck.org has done an incredibly precise job on just going through these claims and debunking them. So, but the problem in the real world is not the real world, but the world we live in, because sometimes facts don't matter, as you well know. He who spins the best wins the argument nowadays. How is the Obama administration, who have not exactly sold the Affordable Care Act from the beginning very effectively, and then they had the botched launch of the website, which reinforced a lot of the negativity that the Republicans have been pounding on forever, apart from yourself and from factcheck.org coming to the rescue here and bringing some truth and clarity, is the White House weighing in?
You know, I'm not sure about that, but I think it's important that you and others are trying to shed light on this issue, and I think that the truth will come out. I mean, it's just like what happened to the exchanges. You know, they worked, people are signing up, and I think that the American people are seeing the success of the ACA. Yes, could the president do more to sell the ACA? Absolutely. But I think the truth will be in how we see all of these things lay out, and we see the more choices that people have in this country in terms of getting affordable insurance. And we'll see those results. I mean, the proof will be in the pudding, really.
Well, that's been one of the suspicions, of course, why the Republicans have just been on such a jihad against it, is a suspicion that what they're ultimately afraid of is that it might actually work. So if that is the sort of vector, if you will, the way you have, you know, a tremendous amount of resources from the Koch brothers and others pouring in against the Affordable Care Act in terms of information and misinformation, how would you assess the dynamics here? In other words, if this is a battle between misinformation and truth, and, you know, the old quote from the Bible, the truth shall set you free, well, in this case, people don't realize that the truth will not set them free so much as but actually benefit them enormously. Where are we in the battle for the truth here?
Right. I mean, I think the Republicans can keep voting to repeal it, but it's not going to go away. Now that people are getting insurance and they couldn't get it before, and you're seeing success story after success story, it's not going to go away. So I'm not even sure what the strategy is on the right to make this somehow not succeed when it is absolutely succeeding. And I would think that they would want to eventually get on the bandwagon and say, okay, fine, this is actually working for people in my district. This is working for people in my state. Maybe I should actually see what positive there is here. And I would hope that that would happen as they hear more and more from their constituents about the positive effects this has had on people.
Well, I asked the question, Elise Gould, because clearly this is an election year, and one assumes that since the Republicans have invested so much in their war against health care reform, that you would assume that they would continue this all the way through to the November election. So in terms of the battlefield in this election year and the order of battle, if you will, what's your sense of whether by October will we still be having these kind of conversations, having to shoot down misinformation and outright lies, or will the benefits of the Affordable Care Act be so much clearer and by word of mouth people will have been able to overcome this, you know, onslaught of well-financed propaganda?
Well, I certainly hope it's the latter. I hope that this becomes very clear, that more and more people get signed up, more and more people see the benefits of this program, and that will just overshadow any lies that are being told.
So, but in terms of the next stages, is there any more shoes to drop? I mean, at this point, we're just more and more people are signing up. The deadline is when? In March, is it not?
Right. So what else is going to happen? People get insurance, and the whole point of this, I think it often gets forgotten, is that insurance isn't the end goal. The end goal is care. So when people have insurance and they find that they can still visit the doctors they want to visit, I think they'll be very happy, and they realize that they don't have large bills that people were, you know, fear-mongering about what they're going to have to pay. I don't think there is another shoe to drop here.
Mm-hmm.
The individual mandate people get, and they are signing up, and that will continue, and this will just progress, I think, step by step. The start of these exchanges was a really big was the next big thing that happened. I don't think we have anything else to look forward to this year in terms of what will happen with ACA except just more enrollment.
Well, but the fact that the job lock is starting to be picked, I guess, to use a metaphor, that's pretty huge, isn't it? I mean, do we have any statistics on how many people are literally stuck in jobs that they don't want because of their health care? And now that there's mobility, that one would think that job mobility would improve the job market, where you'd actually have people going after jobs that they want and that they're qualified for, as opposed to being stuck in a job that they have accepted simply because it provides them with the health care they need for their family.
Right, right. That is absolutely a good thing. And it will not just be people, you know, switching to different jobs. It could be people starting businesses. That's at the margin where I think we're more likely to see that. So we could look in the labor market data over the next year and see if we can find any trends there. You know, what's tricky is that our economy is still very sluggish. And so any vacancies that are left open as people may perhaps leave their jobs and move on, those will hopefully get filled by people who are now currently unemployed or out of the labor market, and we'll likely see the unemployment rate could go down. It's hard to attribute any particular movement of the ACA to that because there's lots of other moving parts in the economy, but I think we should definitely be watching the labor market and see what could be happening there.
Well, but in terms of the U.S. labor market and the state of working America, since I've spent some time in other countries, I think I have a reasonably objective perspective, and I don't think in any other country in the world people work as hard as they do in the United States, and they don't have the benefits that most social democracies provide their citizens by a long shot. Even next door in Canada, people get so much more benefits. And one of the most flagrant examples of how the U.S. is behind the rest of the world in working conditions is in the lack of vacations. I mean, Americans are lucky to get 2 weeks at most. Europeans get 6 weeks fully paid. So in your line of work, have you been able to make these comparisons? Do people really know how much worse off they are, and that a incremental step like the Affordable Care Act is actually taking them towards conditions that the rest of the world enjoy.
Right, right. I think that there are many people who back off from those international comparisons, but I think it's an important point to make. We look at things like you're talking about vacation days. Let's take a one step back from vacation days. How about paid sick days, right? There's no mandate in this country that people get paid sick days to take care of themselves when they're sick, or to take care of their children when they're sick, or an elderly parent, or whatever might need to be done. There's not a minimum. It's not one day. It's not 2 days. It's 0 days. So in terms of minimal labor standards, we are absolutely far behind many of our international peers, and I think that's one place that's an obvious place to start. You know, we think about just having basic benefits. That's a very clear one. Obviously, we've seen a pretty huge decline in defined benefit packages in the workplace for retirement, and we have seen a decline in employer-sponsored health insurance. So hopefully the ACA will, you know, be one step in moving us towards a better social safety net, and we have absolutely a long way to go before we've taken on all of the different issues that I think many of our international peers have already tackled.
And have you ever figured out why it is that somehow we're in this bubble of disinformation where, you know, we keep getting told how great things are? And I don't know whether you recall the Republican primaries last election cycle where all of the presidential candidates on the Republican side were saying how great America is and how great our health care is, that we have the best health care in the world, et cetera. Is there any explanation to your mind why it is that the international comparisons can't break through boosterist sort of happy talk nonsense that goes on?
That's a great question. I think I'd be better suited for a political scientist. I'm an economist, so I can talk about the numbers, and I think that people should be paying attention to the numbers and paying attention to the trends and paying attention to us versus, not versus, but, you know, in the context of other countries. I think that is useful information to bear. I think that, to bring to bear. I think that the arguments that are made in political contexts often have other motivations other than.
That might explain Eric Cantor's false claims again about the CBO report,
right?
That you and factcheck.org have debunked. So there we have it, I guess. I thank you for joining us, Elise. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Elise Gould, who's the Director of Health Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute, where her research areas include employer-sponsored health insurance, inequality and health poverty, economic mobility, and the employer tax exclusion. She is a co-author of The State of Working America, 12th edition, and she just wrote the piece, No, the CBO Did Not Find That the ACA Kills Jobs. And that, of course, is available at, website?
Our main website is www.epi.org, and you can click on our blog there, and you can find it there.
Well, thanks again, Elise.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an analysis of what's wrong with the trillion-dollar farm bill. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Craig Cox, the Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group. He has worked for the National Academy of Sciences, the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and is Executive Director of the Soil and Water Conservation Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Cox.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And the president is expected to sign the farm bill that passed out of the House earlier and the Senate, and it comes to about $956 billion over 10 years. That's roughly $1 trillion. It has less than half of the $38 billion in savings that the president had called for. And the savings it has seem to have come out of the poorest of our citizens, where, you know, almost 1 million American families are going to be affected with cuts in food stamps. So why are they calling this a bipartisan victory?
Well, we certainly don't call it a bipartisan victory. We think it's a major missed opportunity to really put in place a farm policy that that meets the needs of the people in this country. And I think what you're seeing in this farm bill is at least the farm policy pieces of this bill are still being written to satisfy the demands of agriculture from the taxpayer instead of really thinking about what does the public need from agriculture.
So it's another way of saying that this is ultimately a victory for the agricultural lobbyists, that they've sort of ground down the reformers?
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, if you follow the money, I think that story becomes quite clear. Exactly 81% of the savings from ending some traditional farm subsidies that is being touted as reform are in fact plowed back into a new suite of subsidies that are likely worse for taxpayers than the subsidies they are replacing, and certainly worse for the environment.
And these are the agriculture risk coverage and a supplemental coverage option. So they're celebrating the idea that you no longer have direct payment subsidies, which result in a lot of farmers not getting paid for not planting crops. They're making the suggestion here that this is a more equitable form of insurance because it's based upon what, weather conditions? I mean, I don't understand the, I mean, obviously none of our audience would be sympathetic to the idea that you pay people not to grow things, but what is it exactly about this new regime that is so beneficial to both the farmer and the taxpayer?
Well, it's certainly beneficial to the farmer, at least some farmers, not all farmers. And the first thing we need to make clear is that the crop insurance program in the last 8 or 9 years has really moved far away from what most people would consider an insurance program, and it's really become an income support program.
You mean like welfare?
Yes, and it guarantees a certain, it guarantees a certain revenue per acre. Now, the farmer producer does need to pay part of the cost of securing that policy, so it's not exactly like welfare, but the program is heavily subsidized by taxpayers. About, you know, on average, taxpayers pick up 60 to 62% of the producer's premium. They pay crop insurance companies $1.3 billion a year to sell and service these federally subsidized policies. And the program is sort of rigged to make sure that these private insurance companies get most of the underwriting gains and the taxpayer picks up most of the losses. I mean, as a result, the crop insurance program is far more expensive than the direct payment program that's being replaced. In fact, if most of what goes in, you know, after this farm bill, the crop insurance and these new programs are likely to cost well over twice as much as the direct payments did. So it's not better for the taxpayer.
Well, apparently there are no means testing in terms of how the money is spent, that people making up to 900,000 dollars in adjusted gross annual income can qualify for payments. So why is there no means testing? And apparently Senator Grassley has objected to it because it has no limit on the number of people per farm that can qualify for payments when so many farms are businesses. So in effect, the taxpayer ends up subsidizing the employees of a corporation, and so they don't have to pay them their salaries. Is that the loophole we're talking about?
Yes, that loophole remains. Mm-hmm. Senator Grassley fought very hard to close that loophole. In fact, he succeeded in getting his provision in both the Senate version of the Farm Bill and in the House version, exactly the same language in both bills. And yet the conference committee went ahead on their own and stripped that provision out and kicked it to the administration to write rules. So that's really unprecedented. Conference committees are not supposed to change legislation that is contained in both House and Senate versions of the bill. They're only supposed to resolve differences.
Again, I'm speaking with Craig Cox, the Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group. He has worked for the National Academy of Sciences, the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition and Forestry, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and as Executive Director of the Soil and Water Conservation Society. So that in itself is very troubling, the idea that in the back room they can override the will of both of the houses. So who was pushing for this idea that, I mean, am I correct in suggesting that this is a form of welfare payments for agribusiness? Because, you can basically have all of your managers, their salaries paid for by the federal government.
Well, I don't think you can have their full salaries paid for, but it is a huge loophole that's been effectively used by the largest and most complex partnerships and corporations to multiply many times the amount of government subsidies that they are supposed to get, including, and the way it works is they include they include their farm workers or other folks as actively engaged in the management of the farming operation, and then harvest subsidies because they have 8 or 10 people eligible to get subsidies in that partnership.
And how could you distinguish between corporate farming and family farming? Because, the family tends to put all of its kids to work, don't they?
Well, what Senator Grassley had proposed was a set of criteria that would have to be met for someone to be considered, quote-unquote, actively engaged in the farming operation. So they would have to demonstrate that they are spending, a significant amount of time on the farming operation, that they have some financial interest in the operation. But he wanted to write in statute some clearer criteria for how USDA would make this determination. And that's the fundamental problem now is that there are no really clear, strict, effective criteria.
So, Craig Cox, the other aspect of it that I mentioned in the opening, and I suppose in terms of you clearly feel that this new farm bill is in effect a kind of bait and switch, and that the benefits that are being touted are extremely dubious. And I suppose given that, the fact that even though it's a 10-year bill of nearly $1 trillion, after 5 years it can be modified, right?
That's exactly right. And in fact, it may be modified sooner than that if this bill suddenly begins to spend far much more money than was anticipated, and there's a high potential for that to happen.
So when the Michigan Democratic Senator, Chairwoman of the Agriculture Committee, Senator Debbie Stabenow, says this is not your father's farm bill, it's a new direction for American agriculture policy, I take it you don't buy that.
Well, I think it is a new direction for agriculture policy. It's just not a very good direction.
Mm-hmm.
It is a departure from the traditional structure of the way taxpayers supported farm income, with one big exception. And it's really substituting this really pumped up crop insurance program for the traditional subsidies as the way taxpayers are going to support farm income. And there's some real problems with transforming crop insurance, which is supposed to be a safety net, into essentially an income support program.
Well, I keep going back to the food stamp cuts, even though, again, people are saying, well, it's not as bad as it could have been if we would have gone with the House version instead of the Senate version. And the current bill that the president's about to sign cuts food stamps by $8 billion over the next decades. But that in itself still reduces benefits for 850,000 households across the country. And I don't understand how you could prioritize crop insurance and all the stuff we've been talking about, all these people getting subsidized in this way that Senator Grassley tried to clarify so that, you know, people weren't just being able to inflate the numbers on paper in order to get more and more subsidies. I mean, it just feels to me completely out of whack that you're talking about billions on the one side being thrown in to a big, generous pot, and then taking money out away from 850,000 households who are already incredibly poor. People who are on food stamps don't choose to be on food stamps. They're not freeloaders. These are people who are really in trouble. They are what the Bible calls the least among us.
Well said. It's horrendous, misguided priorities to take money away from working families, and many of the benefits flow to hungry kids, in order to beef up benefits to some of the most financially secure farming operations in the country. It's outrageous, and the salt in the wound is it's totally unnecessary. If they wouldn't have done this bait and switch that we just discussed and instead just ended these, you know, totally discredited direct payment programs, there would have been plenty of money to exceed the deficit reduction that the committees are claiming for this farm bill and not cut food stamps at all, and instead invest in new programs or existing programs that actually help people eat healthier.
So does this then, Craig Cox, come down to the power of the agribusiness lobby? Is that why we ended up with what we ended up with, as opposed to what you just suggested we could have had in a, I was going to say a more perfect world, but maybe I should say a less corrupt world?
I think it's an indication of the power, the continuing power of the agriculture subsidy lobby, which is now augmented with the crop insurance lobby, because crop insurance companies are making huge profits through this federally subsidized insurance program. And, you know, the fundamental problem that we faced in farm bill after farm bill is it's just difficult to get members of Congress that who aren't in farm states really engaged in shaping the farm bill.
Well, apparently a lot of the votes come from farm states, and there's an odd thing going on in Arkansas where Senator Pryor is supposedly vulnerable, and he's being challenged by a Republican congressman who actually voted against the farm bill because he's a Tea Party guy who felt that it was too expensive. And yet the other senator from Arkansas, who's a Republican, voted for it and praised it. So you can see the politics of it. And how do you think the politics are going to play out in terms of in rural America? Do people just basically want the money? They don't care about any budget busting aspects of it?
You know, that's really hard to predict. I mean, it seems to us when you look back at previous elections that the Farm Bill has not really played a big role in the outcome of local elections, at least as far as we can see. I think it's been overplayed as an important bill for local elections, except in, you know, those districts that are really dominantly agricultural.
Well, but the irony that I see is that, you know, you have in red state America very conservative politics, you know, Republican and, you know, very Christian right kind of people get reelected fairly regularly, and they all campaign on free market values and freedom, et cetera. And yet, you know, what we were talking about in terms of this farm bill is how much it's really a form of welfare. So does that irony ever come up in the politics of rural and red state America?
Certainly. A number of people, especially, you know, journalists, have pointed out this irony, or perhaps better called hypocrisy, especially this time around when we're talking about hurting poor and hungry people while beefing up government benefits to millionaires. It's been repeatedly brought forward. It doesn't seem to affect the outcome, unfortunately, this time around.
So, Craig, I detect a certain weariness in your voice. When are you going to come out fighting, and with what?
Well, we fought really hard for the last 2.5 years on this bill, and we did harvest a couple of important victories, especially on the environmental side. There's a critical provision, you know, known as conservation compliance, that asks farmers to take some basic measures to protect soil and water and wildlife habitat in return for these generous subsidies. That provision was in serious risk of being eliminated in this farm bill, and we managed to make sure that it's still there. And there are some increases in support for some good food and healthy food programs. There are some improvements in the conservation programs, but they're unfortunately just so far outweighed by these really, really bad priorities and this new subsidy mechanism that is just really unwise. So we're gonna, you know, we're not through fighting. There's a lot of fights to be fought as this farm bill becomes implemented. There's a lot of opportunities to shape it in ways that make it less bad. I do think if there's still a lot of attention on the federal budget, that the budget busting potential of this bill could put it right in the bullseye for finding savings even before the next farm bill. So we're not giving up by any means.
Well, Craig Cox, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Craig Cox, who's the Senior Vice President for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the Environmental Working Group. He has worked for the National Academy of Sciences, the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition and Forestry, the United States Department of Agriculture, and is Executive Director of the Soil and Water Conservation Society. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the unprecedented rebuke of the Catholic Church by the United Nations. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He is a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double-Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you very much.
And it appears to be somewhat unprecedented that a large institution should be so publicly shaming another institution. But the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child have issued a report calling on the Vatican to immediately remove child abusers. And this is, again, it strikes me as very unusual that this should be happening in such a public way.
I agree. It's on an international scale. It's a little bit of the appearance, anyway, of crossing the church-state divide. I don't think it is actually that way, but I think it does have that appearance. I think it represents a great deal of frustration on the part of the United Nations that's had this request in for basic information for, I believe, 17 years. They've been waiting for this report, and finally, I think the pressures and frustrations reached a point where they felt they needed to do something more pointed and more dramatic to call attention to the fact that the Vatican has not responded to their request for a report on the amount of abuse that's gone on and the processing of the offenders. And that's the motivation behind it.
But the Vatican have traditionally given precedence over what they call church law or canon law over criminal law, and I guess by extension, international law. Now, the Vatican, of course, does have a seat on the United Nations, which is somewhat unusual in itself. What's been the reaction from the Vatican?
Well, the Vatican says that it has soft-pedaled it in the sense of it says it regrets this is going on and it'll look into it and so on. But quite honestly, this is one issue that the new Pope, for all the favorable reviews he's received in many other ways, has not really dealt with this issue. And I think the vacuum, a lack of response, a fuller response from Rome on the whole issue of child abuse has left open this kind of appeal for greater accountability from the world, just the way civil instruments in the courts in the United States have taken up issues of child abuse by priests when church officials have lagged behind in giving public accounting or doing anything about the perpetrators. So I think there's a mirror image here of what's happened in the United States, where in that vacuum the secular forces and the civil forces have moved in.
Well, apparently, Kenneth Briggs, the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child have not only focused on pedophilia and child abuse, sexual abuse of children within the Catholic Church and the extent to which the hierarchy has covered it up. They've also singled out Ireland's Magdalene Laundry scandal as an example of how the Vatican has still failed to provide justice for these slave-like conditions, which included degrading treatment, violence, and sexual abuse in these laundries, which were essentially workhouses for some 10,000 women and girls who were required to do unpaid manual labor from 1922 all the way up till 1996.
I agree that refocusing and giving putting the magnifying glass on that, it does renew concern about that, which was in its own way highlighted by the recent movie whose name I can't remember offhand.
Philomena,
which has risen the visibility of that issue all over again. So it does add more pressure and more of a spotlight on that. And I want to add, too, I think some of this message on the part of the United Nations may reflect a heightening of concern about children in general around the world, about the welfare of children. And they may be moving into an area where the public awareness of abuses of a much, much wider strain is very much on the minds of more and more people. And I mean the questions of what happens to African children who are homosexual, children of Syria, the children who have been killed as a result of United States drone strikes. I think there's an alert and a focus that they now have built upon and used and piggybacked on in some way to emphasize not only those issues within the church, like the laundry, but also the wider concern about what's happening to children in so many places in the world.
Well, of course, the Pope, ironically, is going to be meeting with the actor in Philomena, Steve Coogan. I don't know whether it's already taken place, but apparently it's to take place soon. I wonder whether he's seen the movie. Why would he be meeting with the actor?
I think I read somewhere where he was going to see the movie.
Right.
There has been response from the Vatican about child abuse, but it's been restricted. It's been somewhat restrained, and it's not really stood up on an international level and said, this is where we have come with it, and this is where we're going to go with it, and we're not going to put up with it anymore, in a way that simply isn't just apologetic for things that have happened that they regret. So I think in the case of the Pope and this kind of incident, it is in the course of things for them to say, well, you know, that we regret that kind of thing happened, but that doesn't tell us much about current policy and what they intend to do in the future to prevent that kind of thing. And I think that there needs to be a lot more initiative taken on that front.
Again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. And we're discussing the UN report that came out on Wednesday from the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child, criticizing the Catholic Church and demanding that the Vatican must immediately remove child abusers. And this, of course, comes at a time when there's been a tremendous amount of good publicity for this new pope, and pushed into the background the previously bad publicity about the child abuse scandal. But this, I suspect, is going to bring it back, and it's going to really call out the pope, who many people think is a breath of fresh air. To your mind, Kenneth Briggs, is someone who covers these issues and has done for some time, do you think that the Pope has in fact enunciated his position about this scandal that has gone on for decades, that's cost the Catholic Church billions and billions of dollars, and has raised the fundamental questions about whether or not the Church would rather pay off and keep this under the and try and sweep this under the rug, then actually deal with the situation, given the billions already paid out?
Yeah, I think when this pope was elected just about a year ago, he came into office with either the official or unofficial mandate to talk about the positive things in the church, or to give a view of the church that would take people's minds off of the bad news that had been going on. The problem was that the bad news had not been resolved yet. And Pope Benedict XVI had done some things to take some action and responded, but it was largely internal, and it didn't really make a big impression on the wider world. So that issue remained just sitting there. And the Pope, the new Pope, was given a break. He was given some leeway, I think, while he settled into office. And while he did, he's made a very positive impression in many other ways. Meanwhile, some of these tougher, more negative issues are still sitting there. And the question has been, is he a kind of good news pope who is able to project a very positive, engaging image to a public that has been wary of the Catholic Church because of these other issues? Is he going to stop there, or is he going to be a reformist pope in the sense that he's going to bring actual change to the structures and daily operations of the Church on a local and a regional basis through the structures of the Church? And that remains the big issue. In a somewhat unrelated way, there is the case of the Catholic school in Seattle that you may have already dealt with on this program, having fired the vice principal for announcing he was going to be married to his male partner. And while it was known that he was gay, it was not, he did not up to that point declare that he was going to be married. So he was fired, and there's been a great uproar from the school and parents, the kids, everybody is on the side of this vice principal because he was very popular and very well liked. So what do the local officials do? They say the school is right, they're following church policy, and he has to be relieved of his duties because he has crossed the line. Not because he's gay, because that's technically okay, but because he's acting on being gay, and that's immoral according to the Catholic Church. There were many people who said, well, why should that be? The Pope has been upfront about his kind of warm attitudes toward people who don't fit the mold. He said in that famous statement, who am I to judge, when he was considering a question regarding homosexuals. Why should I judge? The question is, the Church does judge, and unless you change the Church's teachings and rules that govern such things, nothing much changes except through maybe a general persuasion or some personal influence. Therefore, in my view, I felt as if the officials in Seattle actually had no option but to follow the procedure. As much as I may disagree with the result of it, it was an instance where the Pope's good feelings, or his generally kind of good nature, does not correspond to what somebody in an official position is called upon to do by the rules and regulations of the Church itself. So whether he will move to change those views and those teachings remains very, very much up in the air. And he has not indicated at all that he will, for example, change the teaching that says that homosexuality is intrinsically disordered. That's a pretty, it sounds a little complicated, but it sounds pretty serious and gruesome. That's what it says. And if you want to change the language, then you can change the language. But saying, who am I to judge, doesn't change the language. And you can always say that the Pope is saying is, the Church already has judged, and they've said it is intrinsically evil in that sense. And so I don't have to go farther than that. So it's a very confusing situation, and it's one that presents itself when people think he has dealt with some things, when he's just dealt with the feelings around such things and made an effort to try to ameliorate some of those hard feelings about issues that people disagree about.
But just in the last couple of minutes, Kenneth Briggs, In effect, what's happening here is the same kind of conflation and ignorance that Vladimir Putin is representing in Russia, where he conflates pedophilia with homosexuality, and they're completely unrelated. And the idea that you stigmatize homosexuals and somehow let pedophiles off the hook is such an appallingly bad priority. It's just sickening. Isn't that part of the problem here, that you're confusing homosexuality with pedophilia?
Well, I think that's what's mirrored in the UN statement, in some sense, that they're saying that the church's views on this thing, even though they're based, those views are based in all kinds of long-standing kind of moral arguments, that they are encouraging that kind of bigotry by making their own pronouncements in their own ways against homosexuality, so that while it lends itself to somebody maybe like Putin picking up that kind of imagined support from the Vatican and running with it, and the same way that things are evolving in Africa with regard to the same issue. So I do think, and children are in the center of all of those issues one way or another. So I do think that the Putin and the expression of that kind of anti-gay and lesbian feeling there has further heightened the stress among people at the UN.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kenneth Briggs.
Thank you very much. Good talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter. He's a professor at Lafayette College and a former New York Times religion editor, and is the author of Power of Forgiveness and Double Cross, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.